Picture a man in 1861, working as a clerk in his father's leather goods store, struggling to support his family after years of failed business ventures. Just 4 years later, he would accept Robert E. Lee's surrender and save the Union. Ulysses S. Grant's personal memoirs, penned while dying of throat cancer in 1885, tells one of history's most remarkable transformation stories, not through boastful triumph, but with the same quiet determination that characterized his generalship. Born Hiram Ulysses Grant in 1822, he entered West Point reluctantly, fought in a war he considered unjust, resigned from the army under clouds of alcoholism, and seemed destined for obscurity. Yet when civil war erupted, this unassuming former captain emerged as the North's most effective commander. His memoirs, completed just days before his death, earned his widow the equivalent of $8 million today and stand as a masterpiece of American literature, clear, honest, and utterly lacking in pretension. They reveal how an unlikely hero changed the course of a nation. Grant never wanted to be a soldier. "I had always a great aversion to guns," he confessed. His father forced him to West Point in 1839, where a clerical error changed his name from Hiram Ulysses to Ulysses S. Grant. He simply accepted it. He excelled at horsemanship and mathematics, but dreamed of becoming a mathematics professor instead. The Mexican War of 1846 to 1848 provided his real education, though he called it one of the most unjust ever waged by a stronger against a weaker nation. Despite moral objections, he distinguished himself, riding through enemy fire at Monterey to secure ammunition, hauling a howitzer into a church belfry to bombard Mexican positions. These experiences taught him tactics and logistics, but more importantly, introduced him to nearly every officer who would later lead Civil War armies on both sides. After the war, frontier postings separated him from his wife Julia and their children. Isolation and boredom contributed to drinking problems that forced his 1854 resignation. The next 7 years brought humiliation, failed farming, failed businesses, clerking in his father's store. These setbacks forged the resilience that would define his wartime leadership. When Fort Sumter fell in 1861, Grant was drilling volunteers in Galena, Illinois. His West Point background earned him a colonel's commission, and his rise was meteoric. After capturing Fort Donelson in February 1862 with his famous demand for unconditional surrender, bagging over 14,000 Confederate troops, he became the Union's first hero. But Grant's philosophy differed fundamentally from other Northern generals. While George McClellan obsessed over capturing Richmond, Grant understood a simpler truth. Find out where your enemy is. Get at him as soon as you can. Strike him as hard as you can and as often as you can. And keep moving on. Territory meant nothing. Destroying Confederate armies meant everything. This aggressive doctrine nearly ended his career at Shiloh in April 1862, when a surprise attack drove his army back to the Tennessee River. Critics demanded his removal, but Grant reorganized overnight and launched a devastating counterattack, turning catastrophe into victory. The Vicksburg Campaign of 1862-63 showcased his genius. After conventional approaches failed, he marched down the west bank of the Mississippi, crossed below Vicksburg, and attacked from the east, cutting loose from supply lines to live off the land. The victory split the Confederacy and demonstrated his ability to execute operations that defied military orthodoxy. When Lincoln appointed Grant General-in-Chief in March 1864, the war entered its endgame. Grant coordinated simultaneous attacks across all theaters to prevent Confederate reinforcement, accompanying the Army of the Potomac against Lee while Sherman moved on Georgia. The Overland Campaign became the war's bloodiest sustained offensive. Beginning at the Wilderness in May 1864, Grant pushed relentlessly south, despite horrific casualties. Unlike predecessors who retreated after setbacks, he kept advancing. When troops realized they were marching south rather than north, they cheered, finally a general who wouldn't quit. At Cold Harbor, a frontal assault cost 7,000 casualties in under an hour, one of his few admitted errors. "I have always regretted that the last assault at Cold Harbor was ever made." Yet he never wavered, executing a brilliant movement to Petersburg, Richmond's supply hub. The 9-month siege gradually wore down Lee's army, while Sherman captured Atlanta and marched through Georgia, the noose slowly tightening around the Confederacy. By April 1865, Lee's army was collapsing, supply lines severed, troops starving, desertion rampant. After Petersburg and Richmond fell, he fled toward Johnston's army in North Carolina. Grant pursued relentlessly, Sheridan's cavalry blocking escape at Appomattox. On April 9, surrounded and exhausted, Lee surrendered. Grant's terms revealed extraordinary magnanimity. Officers kept sidearms and horses. Soldiers could go home unprosecuted after pledging not to fight again. The meeting was strikingly civil. Grant in mud-splattered uniform, Lee immaculate with ceremonial sword. Learning Confederate cavalrymen owned their horses, Grant let them keep the animals for spring planting. When Union officers fired victory salutes, he stopped them. "The war is over. The rebels are our countrymen again." This generosity aligned with Lincoln's vision to bind up the nation's wounds. Grant ordered rations shared with starving Confederates. The Appomattox terms became the model for subsequent surrenders, easing the transition to peace and demonstrating that reconciliation, not retribution, would guide Reconstruction. Grant's personal memoirs, written while dying of throat cancer in 1885, represent a remarkable literary achievement. After being swindled in a Ponzi scheme, he signed with Mark Twain's publishing company to provide for his family. Despite excruciating pain, requiring cocaine-laced water to numb his throat, he completed the manuscript days before his death. The memoirs feature clear, direct prose and honest self-assessment. Grant avoids flowery Victorian language, candidly discussing his 1854 resignation due to drinking, tactical errors like Cold Harbor, and evaluating generals with remarkable fairness, including Robert E. Lee. Grant's literary style mirrors his military approach, straightforward, purposeful, effective. The memoirs showcase tactical creativity, coordinated theater-wide operations, innovative use of railroads and telegraph networks, modern logistics planning. They also reveal profound humanity. Despite commanding hundreds of thousands in bloody campaigns, he never became desensitized to suffering, describing Shiloh's fields where one could have walked across the clearing in any direction, stepping on dead bodies without a foot touching the ground, a haunting image that stayed with him for life. Ulysses S. Grant's transformation from failed businessman to celebrated general embodies American redemption. His greatness lay in understanding what the war required and unwavering commitment to finish it. Where others saw obstacles, Grant saw opportunities. Where others avoided battle, Grant sought engagement. Lincoln observed, "Grant is the first general I've had. He doesn't ask me to do the impossible." During the Overland campaign, he demonstrated resolve by continuing to engage Lee despite heavy casualties, declaring, "I propose to fight it out on this line if it takes all summer." Rising from humble origins through merit, overcoming failures through perseverance, exercising power with restraint, Grant embodied the best of American values. Racing terminal cancer, he wrote, "I cannot stay to be a living witness to the correctness of this prophecy, but I feel it within me that it is to be so." His judgment proved sound. The nation he preserved would become stronger and more united. History chose not the obvious hero, but the quiet clerk who understood when duty demanded action and refused to turn back.